Thank you, Joe. And now Ann Wortham. Ann is a professor of sociology at Illinois State University, where she's taught since 1991. She teaches courses in the history of sociological thought and social stratification, and her scholarship interests include the sociology of culture, history of ideas, and American political culture. She's the author of The Other Side of Racism, a philosophical study of Black race consciousness, and numerous articles on civil rights policy, multiculturalism in education, the politics of victimhood, the melting pot ideal, and American culture. Anne.
Good, what is it? Morning. I was going to focus on why it is that someone would conform to the expectation of forced redistribution according to the standard of social justice, and I want to do that. But Patrick Burke's reference to the 1964 Civil Rights Bill and the Martin Luther King speech just rang bells in my head, because I was a young person then, and I thought that I might just start out by just filling in some of that, and also maybe explaining, why am I here? And it goes back to those days of the arguments for civil rights when I was a college student and preparing to join the Peace Corps, which I learned later was a mistake. But at the time, I was wrestling with the idea that I thought was problematic, which was that in order for blacks to be treated equally by the government would have to violate the rights of whites. And I just could not get that idea into my mind that it was somehow right to indict an entire race of people in order that my rights might be protected. It just didn't make any sense to me. There was no one to talk to except a very commonsensical notion that something unjust was afoot here. I don't even know if I used the word unjust. I just knew that I was being asked to do something that I just felt was not right to do, and that was to indict a whole race of people a group of people just because they're white. Well, on the day that Martin Luther King gave his speech, I was in Washington preparing to go for training for the Peace Corps and was leaving that day and didn't go to that speech. The landlady I was living with said, "Aren't you going?" And I said, "No, I have to go home." So I went home, faced a boycott that was occurring of some stores in my town, and I went into the store, bought what I had to buy, and walked out, and heard the word traitor as I walked out. And I tell this because sometimes we don't really think about who are the recipients of all of these acts of justice, and how are they responding to those who believe that it is their duty, as they say, to have their benefits redistributed to others. And here I was supposedly to be on the receiving end of some laws older people were passing. Now, let's move this to my being in the Peace Corps in 1964. The bill is passing, and I'm having arguments with Peace Corps volunteers about this. I didn't have a good language with which to argue. I was totally defenseless, really, in terms of intellectual tools. All I knew was that I was being asked to indict them simply because they were white, and that I didn't want to do that. And they didn't like it because I wouldn't do it. And we were having these debates about around that issue. And the bill was passed. There was also discussions about Vietnam at the time. The way I was talking led one of my volunteer friends to say, "You sound like that crazy novelist I read about," whom I had never heard of. Ayn Rand, the name came up for the first time in Tanzania, East Africa. When we arrived there, it was Tanganyika. I was in the third group from of the Peace Corps. This was 1964, and it was Tanganyika. Then when we left, it was Tanzania. So Ayn Rand's name emerges. He said, there's this article in Playboy that you've got to read. I read the article in Playboy, and it didn't make a lot of sense to me, except there was one thing she said about the people who accused and condemned Jesus Christ were actually condemning virtue in order to absolve themselves of the requirement to live virtuously. That hit home, but that hit home because of my dad's teaching. And to speed up the story so I can get on to what I really am here to talk about, this young man got the Playboy magazine article. I read it. He got it from a local Duca, because Playboy you could find even in Tanzania. And I read it, and as I said, it didn't make a lot of sense to me. But it turns out, a few months later, we were on vacation from our duties as teachers. I was a teacher in the Peace Corps then, in Uganda, Kampala, Uganda. And traveling around, you know, buying curios and so on, we went to a rummage shop, and there was a British edition of Atlas Shrugged, a paperback edition. He said, "You gotta get that book and read that book." Well, he wasn't recommending Rand as someone I should feel positive toward. He was trying to give me an example of what was wrong with my arguments, which I, as I say, were not all that fully developed. So I got the book Atlas, and I tried to read it, and it didn't make a lot of sense to me. Mainly because of my lack of education. And you'll think this really crazy, but it was a few months later, at a tea plantation owner's house, there was a paperback copy of The Fountainhead in his bathroom, unread. And I said, "Can I have it?" He said, "Yes, you can have it." I began reading that book, and it was entirely different. On the back of it was reference to the Nathaniel Brandon Institute and their lectures. I wrote them a letter and asked if I could get their lectures. "No, we don't have the lectures that we can mail to you, but we've got some brochures of books." Make a long story short, I left the Peace Corps. Well, actually, I tried to leave after I'd read some of the books I got, and they said, "If you want to leave, you'll have to pay your own way." I couldn't pay my own way, so I had to stay in. But I left the Peace Corps with Goldwater's Conscience of a Conservative, and with Ludwig von Mises' Anti-Capitalist Mentality, the red and black edition. It's all marked up, because I read those while I was there, and all the time I'm getting stronger and stronger in my arguments with my Peace Corps volunteer friends. And by the time I returned to the United States in 1965, on that day, Watts was burning. And I understood now what was happening, that it truly was an assault on individual rights. And then I studied all of that and wrote my first article in The Freeman in 1966, which was reproduced in the congressional, or entered into the congressional record by John Ashbrook. And so a lot has happened between that day and this, but Patrick's reference to the 1964 period just called up all of those memories of how it was in those days. But mine is a story, too, about the transmission and the power of ideas, just coming in contact with these ideas as I did. And by the way, I got those books because I did ask the Nathaniel Brandon Institute to sell me books, and my dad paid for them, and they shipped them to East Africa, and that's where I met Ludwig von Mises and Aristotle and all those wonderful people who have been a part of my life ever since. Okay, so now we get this young man who tells everybody, "You didn't build that." And he's proclaimed as his presidency, or his ability, say what he's saying, is proclaimed as a signal event in the life of anybody who happens to be black like me. And I must say, I had, on the day of that election, disavowed any connection with that young man. In an email, an article, which went viral all over the place. But now he's saying, You didn't build that. And people are asking, what's wrong? Why is he saying this? Well, if they'd taken my sociology classes over the years, they would have known that they were witnessing a socialized mind at work, a collectivized mind at work. He believes it. He truly does believe what he says. But I wanted to address that question of, why is he talking the way he's speaking, by looking at the ideas of John Rawls, his idea of justice as fairness, but also the work of pragmatists, social scientists, sociologists, and social psychologists. So the question to me is, what kind of person — we've already heard what the Rawls' theory is — those who have a good fortune can gain from that only to the extent that their advantages are used to improve the lot of those who have the least advantage. What kind of person would conform to this expectation of redistribution? What kind of person would conform to the view that they should sacrifice the fruit of their advantages to the benefits of the least advantages? The plausibility of that conformity, in my mind, rests on a particular conception of society, a conception of the human self, and a conception of the relationship of the two that prevails today in philosophy and social science. The society of equals that Rawls posits would be organized as a team, an association which responsibility is interchangeable, and success or failure of any member is the fate of all. Responsibility is interchangeable because each member views himself or herself not as a sovereign, self-responsible, and morally autonomous individual, but as the embodiment of the team. I am society, is their view. They see themselves as a carrier of shared normative consensus that unites this team. The theory requires not a concept of the individuated self, of Enlightenment individualism, but the concept of the deterministic socialized self that I argue Mr. Obama is just the epitome of. He came out of our culture, produced this kind of self that is at the center of our welfare state. Such a person would have to possess that kind of self that would enable them essentially to say that I will give back to society that which was never mine in the first place. I've always thought of, whenever I hear that term, give back, well, what did I take that you want me to give back? And lots of people, conservative, liberals, in between, love this term, give back. I hate it because it is asking me to participate in a lie. I have to indict myself of something that I didn't do. I didn't take anything, people. This give back for redistribution is something that such a socialized individual would not find extraordinary at all. The less advantaged, that is, an advantaged person who is of that predisposition, would not find that at all problematic. Witness people like Warren Buffett, advantaged, who are quite willing to use the state, to have the state take it from them, when they could just as easily volunteer, they give it up, but they'd rather have the state do it than it can take from all of us. The less advantaged are also in agreement with this redistribution expectation. They fully expect that their wants will be met by others, and they fully expect that those whose resources are expropriated to confer in this violation of their rights. And I, thinking back again to 64, I mean, I didn't recognize it at the time, but I realized why my colleagues were so upset with me. I was supposed to agree that they were guilty just because they were born white. Then we could have a deal. then we'd have this harmony. And I'm saying, but you didn't do anything to me personally, and I can only judge you personally. So I can't indict you as an individual just because you're white. Well, this whole idea of the socialized individual who is advantaged or one who is disadvantaged, they have agreed. The advantaged person agrees, I should comply with this redistribution expectation, and the disadvantaged person agrees that he should or she should comply with it, and that he or she should be the benefit. They don't ask as I did. I don't think this is right. They believe they are entitled to it, because after all, who is the author of those resources that have been produced? Nobody knows, so they're told. Luck made it happen. Well, I wanted to look a little bit more closely at some of the interactions that people of this persuasion who are conforming to this expectation might have. One of the crucial elements of the socialized self, but not unique to it, is intersubjectivity. Now, that's one of those sociological buzzwords or jargons, but I have to use it because it says what it means. It consists of empathetic understandings, implicit meanings, shared definitions of reality that are conveyed among people through symbolic gestures. We all recognize it. Symbolic gestures and language in the communication process. Jürgen Habermas spoke of a web of intersubjective relations that functions as a bridge between the world, the private world of the individual, and the shared public world of others, and makes possible mutual interdependence. It is this feature of the self-society relationship that enables people to conceive of relations with others as we're all in this together, which happens to be another of the slogans used by such socialized advocates as our president. Intersubjectivity is a significant element of Obama's practice of politics. On the campaign trail, he's been called the campaign in chief, that's all he does. He easily establishes intersubjectivity through language, gestures, and again, it's not unique to him, but it serves a great deal of his purpose. Spontaneous high fives with voters, we see that a lot. Bashing the rich, that's always done. Intersubjectivity feeds also, very seriously now, the collapse of the boundary between citizen and state. This is very important. Every time I see him doing this, I just go, God. You know, we could just say, Mr. Obama, go to the devil, I don't want to hear you. Well, not many people actually do listen to him. Fortunately for our country, in a way, but this is a strategy that is seriously used politically to collapse that boundary, that all important boundary between citizen and state, between private and public sectors. If we can all believe that we're all in this together, okay, i.e., that we are the state, we are the embodiment of the state. Well, I mean, it's just easy from there. He evokes sympathy in audiences by conveying empathy for them in statements that amount to, my governance is not me in action, but me as you. I am you. Again, this is not unique to him. We just happen to be faced with his playing out this scenario now. Empathy and mutuality are also expressed by contrasting himself as the paternalistic servant of the people with the profit-seeking rich who, as Vice President Biden claimed, don't get who we are. Intersubjectivity, as I said, feeds that collapse that is so necessary. It really is a necessary component of human communication. We can think about intersubjectivity in terms of its altruistic manifestation, or in terms of its individualistic manifestations. The altruistic view is, which is the one that those who advocate social justice incorporate, virtually involves interaction with other people, seeing each other as means to the other's end, in which one has a duty to serve the interest of others. For instance, in this context, we're all in this together, could express the speaker's belief that his self-identity is one with others, I am the other, and that there is no moral space between them, between himself and those with whom he interacts. Indeed, there's no moral space between him and all of humanity. Such a collectivist notion or orientation can be used to justify the welfare state's moral hazard of encouraging people to engage in risky behavior in the belief that the cost of their behavior will be borne by others. After all, I am you, you are me, we're all in this together. You are the means to my ends, I am the means to your ends. So, take the risk. Somebody else will shoulder the burden of it. Now, the contrasting context of intersubjectivity is what we might speak of as self-interested intersubjectivity. We're all in this together takes on a different meaning. It could mean our shared human existence depends on each person's understanding of himself as self-generated, self-regulated, self-responsible. And instead of saying, I am the other is me, we say, I am the self I am responsible for creating, which of course means everything that I do is my responsibility to manage and have control over as much as possible. Relations among such individuals are maintained on a shared assumption that each person is responsible for his moral autonomy and his choices. Their exchange of material and spiritual values is carried out in the understanding that no one expects from the other that what he or she has not earned, i.e., they expect justice, the real justice, and that no one will demand or accept the sacrifice of the others. Again, I have to go back to my conundrum of the 64. I just didn't know why these kids couldn't understand I was trying to be fair. I wasn't expecting them to view me by virtue of the color of my skin, to get something from them that I didn't deserve, or to use the state against them just because they're white. They just couldn't seem to understand that I didn't want their sacrifice. They're willing to give it because that meant that they were virtuous. Later on, in many, many conversations I've had with liberals, it always comes down to this, why they get so mad at me. Because I won't let them make the sacrifice. They want me to absolve them, to give credit to their willingness to simply declare that they are of no consequence for my interests, and therefore have their own virtue acknowledged. And I just will not play that game of corruption, because it is corruption. It requires that they lie, that I lie, and then we can't talk to each other, and we'll just spend the next 40 years as we have talking about, can we talk? That conversation that Bill Clinton's always wanting, you can't have it between two liars. I don't know. You know, I keep saying, well, we could talk if you guys would let me say what I want to say, which is that you're free. Go home. You don't owe me anything. But they don't want to hear that. Okay, let me go on with a couple more comments here about this intersubjectivity business. I thought that you'd be interested to just to share with me some other observations of this. this collapsing again of the moral boundary, the collapsing of personal jurisdiction between individuals, the denial of their moral sovereignty. When people practice this, how does it look? Well, you're doing it, it means you've got to treat everyone equal. You've eliminated any means by which you can judge people based on their own personal character. We're evening the playing field of character. This is the approach that Obama took in his Roanoke speech. He says, "I'm always struck by people who think, my success must be because I'm just so smart." And he denigrated this. He says, there are a lot of smart people out there. He dismissed that. And the audience seemed to understand what he was saying. Okay. Such rhetoric implies what Richard Weaver has called the perverted notion that in a just society there can be no distinctions. That's the point my colleagues have made today. By evading individual distinctions, it also evades the reality of the hierarchy of values and the necessary inequality of character, performance, and achievement. Just as conformity to the social justice standard involves the disconnection of material advantage from the person who legitimately produced or earned them, it also involves the severance of prestige and virtue. The advantage to value the esteem of the team and want to avoid being penalized for their advantages often engage in what David Brooks calls one-downsmanship. We all recognize this. The practice of seeking prestige and respect by performing a series of feints to show how little one's worldly success actually means to the person. Brooks describes this phenomenon among the educated elite, whose conversations are devoted to mocking your own success in a manner that simultaneously displays your accomplishments and your ironic distance from them. To quote him, "You will talk about your nanny as if she is your close personal friend." We've been in these conversations. As if it is not a weird triviality that you happen to live in a $900,000 Santa Monica house and she takes the bus 2 hours each day to the barrio. You will perfect a code that subtly downplays your academic credentials so that if asked where you went to school, you'll reply, "Harvard," with a little uplift at the end of your pronunciation, as if to imply, "Have you ever heard of it?" Don't talk about it. I have to bring up Ayn Rand's name again. She calls this symbolic leveling altruistic appeasement, which employs self-abasement to escape being reproached for one's achievement. And my point here is that for this to work, it's just this kind of behavior on the ground that we all witness all the time that is engaged in, that resonates when a collectivized character like our president speaks. The individual will apologize for his or her intelligence and attempt to placate the resentment of the less endowed by dedicating his thought and resources, or her thought and resources, to the common social altruistic goal. And this brings me to, I just want to sort of end on one more point, to the ideal of the cause greater than self. Again, our socialized person is trying to maintain this distance in between himself or herself and others, to collapse that moral autonomy that is standing there that we all recognize important in its insistence on self-responsibility as the other side of freedom. They want to eliminate all of that, the stress and strain of that expectation of living in a free society. And so in order to appear that their gains are not illegitimate, One way that one can do so is to embrace the idea of a cause greater than self. Advantage members want to avoid the communities, the loss of the community's respect for them. They'll conform to that expectation by embracing this economic patriotism that we hear Mr. Obama speaking of. Also, Senator John McCain has spoken of economic patriotism. In the 70s, it was called social responsibility. They will do so because they mistakenly believe that self-interest is necessarily in conflict with community. Believing this false dichotomy has been a major theme in American political culture since the nation's founding. In 2012, former President Bill Clinton said before the 2012 National Democratic Convention that it's expressing this dichotomy, that the kind of country Americans want to live in depends on their choice between, to quote him, "You're on your own, winner-take-all society," and a country of shared prosperity and shared responsibility, we're all in this together society. They will agree, such people who want, to avoid the loss of the community's respect. They will agree with Mr. Obama's belief that we're all in this together. They believe his speech to students, one speech of his to students in which he said to them, espousing this altruistic ethic, that our individual salvation depends on our collective salvation. Such people who buy into this will think of Mr. Obama's enunciation as quite sincere, because they will note, if they're aware of it, that he said this also to his daughters in a letter that was published by him to his daughters after his inauguration. He said to them, "Not just because you have an obligation to give something back to this country that has given our family so much, but because it is only when you hitch your wagon to something larger than yourself that you will realize your true potential." His lesson is by no means unique to him, as I know we all recognize. We can find meaning and reward by serving some higher purpose than ourselves, has been enunciated by people like former President George H.W. Bush. He did so in his inaugural address of 1989. His words echo those echoed by those of John McCain and others. Neoconservatives William Crystal and David Brooks have called this ethos national greatness conservatism. A new public ethos, they say, would be a unifying American creed. It would marry, because they see a dichotomy, they see this as marrying community, goodness, and national greatness. They would see this ethos reinvigorating the nationalism of Alexander Hamilton. By the way, whose neck, if I could get it, I would wring. I don't like Alexander Hamilton. I just couldn't resist that, because I always think about, ooh, God, I'd like to get him. Anyway, but Alexander Hamilton and Teddy Roosevelt, another one I'd like to get. These neoconservatives think that the virtues of duty, loyalty, honesty, discretion, self-sacrifice would inspire Americans to subordinate their narrow self-interest to the larger mission of the country's national destiny. Since we can ennoble ourselves by freely choosing to assist others, one might think that in calling the students, as Obama did, and his daughters to public service with this, "we're all in this together" ethos, that he was encouraging the virtue of generosity. As has been noted, he wasn't. He promotes generosity as an obligation to which others are entitled. Not as the voluntary practice that it is. To be sure, we have moral responsibilities to others. But as Tibor McCann, philosopher, points out, we have these responsibilities not because those who might benefit from them are entitled, but because of our choice to live human lives within the company of others. In Obama's perspective, as a member of the collective, an individual's moral worth is not sovereign, but dependent on serving the welfare of others. It's quite a different conception. Thus, he promotes the cause greater than self credo as a justification for the redistribution of wealth and assets by equating generosity and compassion with redistribution. And that's why so many Americans have a difficult time of saying, what you're asking me to do is something I don't think I should be doing. Because they are themselves not sure if he isn't just asking them to be generous, but he's asking them to be generous as someone who has the power to use the government as the instrument of that generosity. And the question is, do we want the government to be the instrument of our generosity, or do we want to make that decision ourselves? McCann writes, those who demand generosity, charity, compassion, or kindness, that it be legally secured by coercive governments, actually destroys the foundations of those moral virtues. By changing them from virtues into enforceable duties. Yet again, American presidents are building their legacies on the transformation of moral virtue into laws of coerced obligation by using tax dollars to finance various bureaucracies devoted to encouraging the growth of volunteerism. Just a couple of these and then I'll shut my mouth. George Herbert Walker Bush's Points of Life received $26.6 million in federal funds, more than half of its budget. George W. Bush created USAID Freedom Corps, which had a budget of $560 million on funding that program. As a key to his policy of compassionate conservatism, the White House Office of Faith-Based and Community Initiatives created by Bush awarded more than $2.2 billion in competitive social service grants to faith-based organizations. By the way, I have never seen any of these people know where they are, except that my students want to join them so that they can get credit. And on and on. It goes on and on. But the point here, these examples are liberal, conservative, in between, but based on this erroneous conception that the government can be an instrument of the generosity that we as individuals can impart and share with one another, when in fact it cannot. And I think I should at this point close, or they'll grab me.
Thank you, Anne. I think we have time for some